It's been 2 years now since writer Paul Auster inaugurated the National Story Project here on Weekend All Things Considered, and that has been a special privilege to share with you listeners. The stories have now become a book collected and edited by Paul. They're called I Thought My Father Was God and Other True Tales from NPR's National Story Project, and Paul joins us now from our studios in New York. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Jackie.
We just debuted this collection in Boston.
Yeah, we just got back about 2 days ago, and it really was a warm event, given all the things that have been happening in the country in the past 3 weeks. It was heartening to see so many people turn out and applaud the readers who came to share their work with everyone. It was a great evening, I thought.
It was great to meet those contributors in person and hear them read, and I really like the kinds of things that we've been able to share with a live audience about how these stories integrate with the national mood right now. And maybe you could say something about that before we get into the story today.
Well, in this moment of crisis in America, we've all been reexamining our country and our values and the principles of democracy. And I think fundamental to all this is the dignity and importance of the individual and the importance of listening and honoring what people have to say. And in this book, we have that. We have the pure, uncensored voices of Americans talking honestly about their lives. And I think it seems to touch a special chord now, even if the stories have nothing to do with the specifics of what we're living through at the moment.
Absolutely. There's a real sort of American corral here. And I'm very delighted that we can welcome to the show today a contributor to the book, Reginald Fair, who joins us now. How are you, Mr. Fair?
I'm fine, thank you.
You're joining us from just outside New York City.
Yes.
You've written a wonderful story called...
Well, thank you.
It's called The Celebration, and Paul, I think, will read it for us now, if you don't mind, and we can talk about it a wee bit more afterward. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
All right, this is The Celebration by Reginald Thayer. August 14th, 1945, VJ Day, the day Japan surrendered, ending World War II. I was stationed at an air base on the outskirts of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We received word of the surrender late that afternoon, and immediately just about everyone on the air base headed into town to celebrate. There weren't nearly enough jeeps and trucks, so most of us hitchhiked in. How peaceful it was as we passed through the gently rolling farmland, with a few cows munching away under a sky that was bluer and brighter than ever, with a few puffy white clouds that were whiter and brighter than ever. What a wonderful state of affairs. I had flown and survived 79 combat missions over Europe without a scratch, would not have to fight in the Pacific, and would soon be going back to college at Columbia after 4 years of military service. The world was at peace, and I was headed into town to celebrate. When I got there, the celebration was well underway. Thousands of soldiers had gathered in the center of town, along with hundreds of civilians. Liquor was flowing freely. As the celebration progressed, I bought a bottle of beer and made my way up to the roof of a one-story building, joining the group that was observing the wild, noisy scene below. Grateful civilians were hugging and kissing the soldiers and thanking us for winning the war. A farmer arrived in a battered old pickup truck and immediately and unwillingly sold the truck to an intimidating group of drunken soldiers who had passed the hat for donations to pay for it. Promptly upon taking possession of the truck, they set it afire. The fire department arrived quickly, with sirens shrieking, hooked up their hoses, and were promptly overpowered by the mob that grabbed the fire axes and severed the fire hoses. As the fire consumed the truck, the crowd, including soldiers, civilians, and even firemen, roared their approval. As the center of action shifted down the block, I came down from the roof and followed. The drunks got drunker and noisier, and what had started out as a joyous celebration of the end of the bloodiest and most terrible war in the history of mankind became a wild, chaotic, violent scene. Store windows were smashed and fights broke out. The few policemen on hand were powerless to bring order to the situation. It didn't even appear that they wanted to. A scuffle broke out involving six or eight white soldiers pummeling a black soldier. There were shouts of, "Kill that nigger! Kill that black bastard!" He managed to break free and run up a side street with a look of stark terror on his face, a look that I'll never forget as long as I live. The mob pursued him, brandishing empty whiskey bottles. To the black soldier's surprise, he found that the side street was a dead-end alley, and there was no way out. I felt that I should go to his rescue, but I was afraid of the mob. As soon as he reached the end of the alley, he turned, faced his pursuers, and stood waiting for their next move. He was dripping with sweat. The look of terror on his face became a look of steely determination. His pursuers all came to an abrupt halt, except for one soldier who advanced toward him, took a swing at him, and got the surprise of his life when he was knocked out flat with one punch. Stepping over the unconscious body of his assailant, the black man clenched his fist and said, "I'm leaving now." There was total silence. Everyone stepped aside, and they let him go. I was tempted to congratulate him, but I was afraid that he would say, "Where were you when I needed you?" After that, I lost interest in the celebration and hitchhiked back to the airbase. Thinking about that ugly incident, I felt guilty that I had not gone to the man's defense. That guilt reminded me of something I had once read in a short story. A man watches in silence as another man is lynched in the Deep South. He is at once shocked and fascinated by what he has witnessed. The mob disperses, leaving the corpse dangling from a tree limb, and the man walks home, ashamed of himself for having been too afraid to intervene. When he walks in the door, his wife, noticing the look of guilt and shame on his face, blurts out, "You've been with a woman, haven't you?"
Oh, that story has so many layers. What is it like to recall that day and hear the story by Paul, Mr. Thayer?
It brings back a vivid memory, just like it happened yesterday.
I wonder, Mr. Thayer, after you got back to the base, did you and your fellow soldiers talk about what had happened, or was it just swept under the rug, so to speak?
We didn't have a big discussion about that incident, no. We were all rejoicing about the war being over, and I don't recall having big discussions about the mob scene.
Hmm. And you don't know who that soldier was and
no,
what happened to
I
him
don't.
After?
I'd love to meet him someday.
Yeah.
Just kind of a nightmare that stays with you for 50 years or so.
Yeah.
And to think of the country celebrating the end of the war and how this man must have felt about what happened to him that day.
Yes.
And where he stood relative to the feelings of the majority.
And he had done his part to win the war, I'm sure.
Tell us about your own wartime experiences, Reginald Thayer.
Well, I was a bombardier on B-17 bombers and flew 79 missions over Europe. Luckily, I never got injured.
And what are you doing now?
I'm a retired insurance broker.
I just wanted to mention that when Mr. Thayer first sent in the story, he made no reference whatsoever to the 79 bombing missions he was involved in. He just said, "I was happy to have survived the war." It was his wife who insisted that he add that detail to show exactly what he had done. Isn't that true, Mr. Thayer?
That's correct. She did.
Yeah. I was very touched by that, and your modesty was also very, very moving to me.
And, you know, I think there's also something, Mr. Thayer, that once again we're aware of American lives at risk in a global context,
yes,
if you will, as opposed to some of our previous conflicts like Vietnam. And your story, does it attain a sort of a special resonance at this time for you?
In an indirect way. I was thinking if I were 20 years old, I'd do what I did in 1941. I go sign up.
Can you remember the mood in the country in 1941, for example?
Yes, I do.
And compare it to what's going on now? Is there a similarity or is there something different?
Well, I think that the outrage and the desire to go get into uniform was a little more widespread and stronger in 1941 and 42, but I see a lot of signs of it right now.
Well, we're very, very glad that you shared this story with us.
Well, I'm happy to have done it.
To learn more about the National Story Project and to read this month's story, go to our website, please, at www.npr.org. And, Paul, I'll see you on the road.
Absolutely, Jackie.
Our next date is October the 17th.
That's right. We're going to be in San Francisco at the Herbst Theater. And I hope those listening in the Bay Area will want to join us.
We had 500 people in Boston, so we expect the other Bay to come out too.
We're keeping our fingers crossed.
Okay, I'll see you soon.
Bye.
Kitty Eisley edits, Tracy Wall directs, Walter Ray Watson produces, with Devar Ardalan, Alice Winkler, Annie Wu, Steve Lichtai, Rob Sachs, and Molly Peterson. The technical director is Abdullah Rufus. Audio engineers include Kurt Turner, Greg Gavin, Joe Woods, Sherry Marcheski, Daniel Shukin, and Radek Broblek. Key Molesky is our reference librarian. Sally Robertson is in the program library. The newscast producer is Quinn O'Toole. Special thanks tonight to Joe Neal, Andrea De Leon, and Kate Concannon. The executive producer for Weekend News is Paul Brown, and I'm Jackie Lydon. Good evening from Weekend All Things Considered and NPR News.